special people change. I'm at a loss to live it strange. Where we are, where we were gonna die. Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where we are, where we were gonna die. Someday you will find.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen! And not a one of you is prepared for it!
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
This week we are Brother Elis. He had a strange occurrence of automotive mayhem, so he will not be joining us. So instead of what we were going to discuss this week, which was The Man with One Red Shoe, which we will revisit next week, I believe, Drew and I decided that we were going to both discuss Supersonic, the Oasis story, which we both watched after. Well, you watched it before we talked about Oasis, correct?
Yes.
I didn't see it until after, and I've now seen it 4 times. So it's
nice.
It's deep in my skull. So today I rewatched it and finished it about an hour and a half ago. And so I have some notes. This is probably best... I was trying to debate this, Brother Drew, and you can tell me what you think. I was trying to decide if this would be better if you'd see the movie and then listen to the podcast about the songs, or if it's better maybe if you listen to the songs and then go watch the movie. And I was thinking, from my perspective, probably best to watch the movie and then go back and watch, and then go back and listen to the podcast where we talk about the songs. But I'll let you answer.
I think I have the opposite opinion, and here's why. The episode we did about the music was about the What's the Story of Morning Glory album, but this movie really takes place before that. So we kind of touch on a little bit of the history of Oasis, and I talk about that movie a little bit, probably too much in that music episode. So I would say listen to that and really get a taste for the music, especially if you're not overly familiar with Oasis, because Eric did a really good job of editing in a lot of clips into that. So I think it'll give you a better. I'm trying to come up with a phrase that doesn't sound as douchey as this one does in my head, but it'd be like a good aperitif to the movie, I think, is to listen to an episode about the music.
Kind of an amuse-bouche.
Yes. Thank you for doubling down so I'm not out there on Douche Island alone.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. So I think it will give you a better perspective, and then going back and watching the movie about how the band was formed. But again, that's probably just based on my experience watching, listening to the music, getting prepared to talk about it with you guys, and then watching the movie at the last minute. I found to be a really enjoyable experience.
I have to say that watching it really brings out a range of emotions. And part of me really wants to stop the movie halfway through and not watch the rest of it.
Oh, I know. I know exactly what you're talking about, because it is such an amazing and meteoric rise. But since we know how it ends, you know, watching the beginning of how that ending starts is pretty painful.
There's a turning point in the movie, which we'll talk about, and I'll bring it up when we discuss it. But I just thought, oh, I should stop watching now. And then, no, I gotta plow through to the end. But, oh, I just really want to stop watching and just restart it. But I also want to point out that it makes me, I wish Brother E could be discussing this with us, if only for the fact that, to quote Noel, the greatest strength in the band was the relationship between Noel and Liam, but that's also what drove the band into the ground. So it's just an interesting perspective. Hopefully we have better success. I also think we have better relationships, perhaps. So
yeah, I mean, we've already reached a higher age than they were when they stopped talking to each other. So well, we've already beat them. But Oasis has really wormed its way into my head more than any of the other bands that we've done episodes about. And I was trying to figure out why. You know, so I think the very first music episode is Marin Cadell, right? And that was you and Eric.
Did we do Marin Cadell or did we do Stanley first?
I think Stanley was like the second half of a movie podcast.
Might have been.
But you know, that was one album. And then Eric and I did Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
And that, you know, while that's one of my favorite albums of all time, again, that's only one album. And then similar with Nirvana and U2. You know, Nirvana is that singular album is more important than any of the others. And U2, it turns out, is not a band I really like all that much as far as their studio albums go. But Oasis, there's something different about Oasis, because it was really difficult for me to just focus on that one album. And since we got that episode under our belt, I've actually been going back and listening to Definitely Maybe a lot. I think the movie also piqued my interest in revisiting it. So yeah, Oasis is one that I still haven't gotten out of my system. So I'm pretty excited to talk about the movie tonight.
Well, and I think also, I mean, when I started listening to Oasis, it was a very formative time for me still, even though I was, you know, in my 20s at that point. It hit me at a time in my life where I had immense change going on, a metamorphosis, and so the music spoke to me. And I think that's why I took it with such depth into kind of my psyche and my spirit, and I integrated a lot of that into my feelings at the time, which is why when I listen, that sense comes right back. And so I think that's why I bonded with it. So because I could listen to those songs and I can distinctly remember where I was listening to certain tracks for the first time and getting chills. So that kind of clarity doesn't often occur, but especially as I age. And yet I can... You know, I can remember the first time I heard Cast No Shadow.
That's similar to me. I mean, it came out, you know, in between my freshman and sophomore year in college. So it's right in that, again, formative time. You know, they say what is popular when you know, around that time when you graduate high school is the music that kind of sticks with you and defines your taste going forward. I don't think that's always true, but I think there is something about, you know, what's going on with your brain when you're about that age, late teens, early to mid 20s, that really lays the foundation for future nostalgia, and Oasis certainly scratches a very specific nostalgic itch for me.
So the movie opens with footage of Nebworth, and there's an interviewer who's talking to Noel, and he's asking Noel, he says, do you think looking back at that time, you know, what do you think looking back at that time? And then the interviewer volunteers, that's a big question. And Noel says, well, it needs a big answer. And that's kind of the opening of the movie where you get to see the breadth and width of kind of where they ended up, but also kind of then it slowly coaxes you into the beginnings. And you notice that they're helicoptering into Nebworth, and then you see a Liam who looked strikingly like John Lennon.
Yes, that was a look he was cultivating.
And then that's where the movie opens, and they flash back 3 years. And then that kind of starts the flashback, and then they talk about Liam starting the band at 16, which was amazing when you think about it. Although they weren't that old, so 16 wasn't that far back for them.
Yeah. I mean, one of the premises that they hammer home in the movie is that, you know, from the time the band really formed when Noel joined to Nebworth was only 2.5 years, which is nuts.
It just seems incomprehensible that they could have covered that distance of ground in that time. That they crammed so much life and activity into such a short period of time, and that would never happen today.
Yeah, let me ask you this while it's on my mind. What did you think of Liam and Noel Gallagher before you watched this movie, and did it change your opinion of either one of them or both of them?
So I didn't know a lot about them from what I read on the news, pretty much. So my opinion of them was that they seemed to be kind of spoiled brats who were troublemakers, because I know that one of them had gotten banned from an airline for some rowdy behavior and harassing of stewardesses. So I just figured they were that typical kind of pop band, cliche, ne'er-do-well troublemaker. So fast forward to watching the movie, I was dumbfounded at the just the sheer self-awareness that they both have to be able to discuss themselves and each other and their family and the dynamic and be so aware, so self-aware of everything that they were engaged in and doing. Even though there was drugs and alcohol involved, they were in control. They were each in their own part of control. And I think part of the problem was that they were both wresting control from each other. And that became the struggle, is that they were fighting each other for control when they both wanted to give each other control in a certain way, and neither wanted to cede enough to be comfortable enough to have the other one kind of slip into that.
Yeah, I was surprised about how smart they were. I mean, yeah. They're not educated, but they're both really smart, really, really articulate.
Yeah, I mean, they've said some dumbfoundingly brilliant things. So just the artistic ability alone is impressive. They talk later about the ability of Noel to play a song for Liam once Liam can hear it and sing it, and Noel can check it, and they could do a bang on a song a day.
Yeah, when they were recording. Yeah,
which and, is impossible.
Yeah, I mean, you might capture lightning in a bottle, you know, once and do that, but that was their MO. I mean, they do that for like 5 or 6 days in a row, bang out a song a day. From scratch. From absolute scratch.
Yeah, Noel would just go in a room and write a song and come out and be like, I wrote a song. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, you know, I made a cheesecake. Here you go.
Before I watched this movie, I thought I'd always sort of mentally blamed Liam for the breakup of the band. And that's probably mostly true. But, you know, I sort of felt like he was just this, he seemed like this, you know, narcissistic perpetrator, and the rest of the band, I assumed, you know, were professionals. But as it turns out, they all were. And this movie actually made me feel really, really sorry for Liam, because he really just couldn't help himself. I don't know if you remember the part where it was towards the end where he was talking about how when he was in front of the crowd and the crowd is going crazy, he was able to stand still like a boxer and just like sit there and take it all in. And that was the only point in the movie where you ever saw Liam like being still. So he seemed like this person that just needed to have chaos around him. If there wasn't any chaos, he would create it. But in those big moments when it was just this big chaotic mass of people, that's when he was able to be really calm. And that was really striking to me, because that seems like a really challenging way to live. You know, if you're sort of in that headspace where you need the chaos, and the only way that you can be calm is if there's a whole bunch of chaos going around. It's almost pathological on his part. It's not necessarily his fault.
Right. I think he's very much a monster of his brother's making, but also of his father's making. I mean, their family dynamic had a great deal to do with both of them, as does all family dynamics, of course. But I think, and I agree with you, it was impressive to see him be able to have that kind of, again, self-awareness and clarity. I don't know that I'm that self-aware. So it's impressive for somebody as young to have come as, you know, through as much as he had, to be able to just say that and like, wow, that's amazing. I do think that he was largely built into the role he was in, and that fostered his attitude, and the band did very little to discourage that, because the mayhem that he stirred up is exactly the notoriety that drew them into the press and drew them into the tabloids and drew them onto MTV and drew them into the limelight. So in many ways, his attitude and behavior just helped foster all of that. And Noel, equally, when he would give interviews intentionally, he said, if I'm going to give an interview, I'm going to give a terrible interview. I'm going to be the worst ass on purpose. And you know why? Because they're going to put me on the cover. And that's all I care about. They can write anything they want inside as long as I'm on the cover. And so that kind of monster maker, that kind of perpetuation, I think, turned Liam very much into the little blossom that he was, just flourished, because he suddenly was frontman for the band and he was the voice and the face. And Noel was happy to make him the front and the face. He didn't want to be up front. He wanted to be the creator back. And in that, he became the puppet master to a small degree, as much as Liam could be mastered.
Right.
But I think that as time went on, Liam realized he was being controlled. So he would turn it up to 11, and he would see how much Noel could try and control him. And it became this contest back and forth. How bad can I behave, and how much can I get away with before things come off the rails? So there was a back and forth. But in that, Noel needed that as much as Liam did. They both fed on each other. They thrived on that. Without that, the band would not have found the success. They might have found success individually in other bands, but they would have never, I think, achieved the level of success. Certainly not. And I don't mean success monetarily. I mean success in the beauty of the lyric and the music and the composition. Noel could have done some of that on his own, and Liam could have done some of that on his own. But together, it was bigger than the two of them. It was the sum of those parts were greater.
Did you watch any of the extras, the two featurettes they had?
I don't have access to that, so.
Oh, they should have come with your iTunes purchase, no, right?
I bought it at Amazon, so.
Oh, okay. Well, they actually had a making of featurette where the director talked about how the project came to him and how he executed it, and it had some footage. And, you know, it's just the dynamic between the two brothers today is equally as fascinating as it was when they were in the band, because they don't speak, yet they are very complimentary of each other. They don't necessarily seem to be harboring, you know, a ton of animosity. I mean, they're willing to call each other out on their faults, but not like in a really bitter, over the top way. Yet they just seem to have this awareness that together they're toxic for each other. So they don't speak. The director had to bring them in separately, multiple sessions, naturally, and would end up asking them essentially the same questions back and forth, and follow up with the other about what one of them said. And that's sort of what created that narrative that sounded like they were telling the same story, but they were never together. Yeah, it's they just seem to have come to this realization that they can't be around each other, even though what they had was magic.
Yeah, and that's the tragedy right there. I mean, that's some Shakespearean tragedy right there. I assumed in my own viewing that it was a back and forth interview where there was a bunch of talking from one of them, and then the interview would go and be like, okay, so he said this, so do you have anything to say? Because it very much had that flow to it. It very much felt like a symphony of parts, if you will.
Yeah, and, you know, you would think that if brothers were estranged like that, if they were both trying to tell the same story, it would seem like there would be lots of contradictions and a lot of, no, that's not what happened. This is what really happened. I didn't get any of that from this movie. They really both seem to be on the same page about their shared history.
Well, and Noel was very forthcoming about owning his shit. He mm-hmm. said at one point, I think when they talked about, was it when he, I don't know, when he assault, maybe when he assaulted Liam with the cricket bat or something, or, but he said, I probably did that. You know, that, I mean, I would, he says, mm-hmm. I probably did that. I don't remember doing that, but I probably did. It sounds like something I would do. So, you know, at least he was honest with himself enough to be able to look back, kind of distance himself. But also I think sometimes as people mature, they get some of that altitude to be able to look back down upon themselves in their former life and be like, well, I was probably a dick. Because I certainly hope I've done some of that in my lifetime where I've, you know, had to ratchet it back a notch and be like, well, maybe I was a little overwrought. So maybe I'm a little bit better, hopefully. Maybe a little wiser and a lot older.
So one of the benefits of having, you know, a long-term companion is to have somebody who can tell you when you're being an asshole.
It's always nice to have friends who are not afraid to call up all the bad bullshit from the past. And like, remember this time you did something really stupid? Yes, I do, because you never let me forget. Yeah. So one of Noel's early quotes is once he discovered weed and guitars and he got into another world, what would you ever want to go out after that? Why would you ever want to do anything? Everything that he ever wanted was coming out through his speakers. And then in he discussed that, I don't know why Liam would be so different. They both came from the same childhood.
Yeah, they later touch on why things might have been different for Liam for Noel.
I can't imagine.
But yeah, that seems like such an asshole little brother thing to do. It's like the older brother's like really into music and writing songs and then goes out and gets a job to hopefully, you know, one day further his interest. And while he's gone, the dickhead little brother is just like, I'm going to start myself a band. Didn't really care about music before, but I'm going to start a band and it's going to be awesome.
Well, and the, you know, the impetus was that Liam got hit in the head with a hammer.
Because he was such an asshole at school.
Yeah, so somebody hit him in the head, and so then he said music clicked. And that's when he told his mom that he was going to be big and famous. He proclaimed, someday he would be big and famous. And her remark was, well, okay, all right, just make sure you do it before I'm pushing up the daisies.
Yeah.
But Noel really didn't want to be part of a band. He just wanted to be basically road crew, which he was. He was just crew for the band.
Yeah. What was the name of the band?
The In Spiral Carpets.
Yeah. Their drummer just died.
Oh, did he?
Like maybe today. Yeah. There was some press from both Liam and Noel about him.
Oh, that's a bummer. But in the In Spiral Carpets was where they met Mark Coyle, their sound engineer. And he immediately attributes in his part of the interview in the beginning of this film that Noel is the boss.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anybody ever disputed that.
Noel did. He said he wasn't really in charge in the beginning. He said that they tried to make it appear that he walked in, you know, like he was from the set of a movie and just took over. He's like, I never did any of that. But you see them very early on discussing things. And then the quote is, I want the severed head of Phil Collins in my fridge. I'm not successful until that happens.
Oh, and Sting. They wanted Sting off the charts,
too. Yeah. They were very nice. And Liam said in the Inspiral Carpets, he admitted that they weren't the best band, but they had spirit, which is what everybody else was lacking at that time.
Yeah, but that gig, you know, as being the roadie for Inspiral Carpets, allowed Noel to, you know, travel around the world for the first time.
He really got to see a lot and experience things. And this started out, and now they're in 1992. And, you know, he's playing them the Live Forever lyrics. And that's when they start in on him. Like, you did not write that. You did not write that song.
Yeah.
There's no way. And then they get their poor mom. And their mom seems like an amazing woman, by the way. Because she seemed pretty grounded and realistic and supportive-ish. She was supportive in that mom kind of way. Like, I want them to get regular jobs, but I just hope they're happy. But she yeah. constantly was worrying about them because they didn't have quote-unquote regular jobs. And this is where they started out. They were basically sharing with the girl band Sister Lovers, where they discuss... This is where it kind of all came together in the beginning. It kind of gelled and they ended up in Glasgow. And the Sister Lovers said, well, they can play after us. And the bar owner was like, no. And they're like, yeah. The bar owner was like, nope. And then eventually they went on and played a set after the Sister Lovers played their set, which they admitted was only like 4 or 5 songs long anyway.
Yeah. So they essentially just... They crashed a gig. And, a band they played with a lot was heading up to Glasgow and said they told them they should come along. And they're like, all right. So they actually like had to pool together money to rent a van to all go up and just crash this gig against the wishes of the owner of the establishment. Did you write down the name of the place? It was something like King Tut's Wawa Shop or something.
Yes.
It looked amazing. But yeah, so that turned out to be their big break when they just decided to show up and play this gig without even being invited.
Well, and they drove up like smoking weed and drinking the entire way. Yep. They're totally, you know, just gacked out of their minds in the van that they rented, which I can't imagine they got the deposit back, but maybe they didn't have deposits in those countries. I don't know how rental cars work in other countries. In America, you'd pay like $1 million if you'd smoked in your car. So, but in the 90s in England, who knows, right? But by the end of the King Tut's Wawa Hut, I think it was. I think you're right. They had a record deal because Alan McGee, who was the boyfriend to one of the members of the female band, had come in to be a dick and threw his girlfriend off on her performance just because he was being a dick.
Oh, I think he was her ex.
Oh, is that what the ex at that point?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So he's like, I'm going to go out and just be a dick. And I heard them play a song and I thought I'm going to sign them to a deal. And I heard them play a second song and so I definitely have to sign them to a deal. And so they had a record deal.
Yeah. Much to all of their surprise.
Well, except for I think Liam, didn't Liam say that this was fate?
Yeah. I mean, that seemed like, rewriting history a little bit.
Well, sure. And then they drove back to Manchester, which they said, you know, it's kind of a surreal experience because we weren't anybody. We just drove back to Manchester. That was it.
Oh, and there was a really sad little, it was almost like an aside from Noel where he got back and told his girlfriend that they got a record deal. And she was like, oh. And they both looked at each other and knew that it was over.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
Yeah. Well, at least in some ways, they knew it was over and they didn't try and fake something that wasn't going to be there. They didn't draw something out just for the sake of drawing it out. You know, clean break sometimes.
I suppose.
And then they talk, and in this part of the movie, you get to talk about history. They go back all the way back to 1962, where their mom moved to Manchester and met Tommy and married Tommy Gallagher after about 10 months of courtship. And then Paul came along 10 months after that. And then Noel was a year later, and then Liam 5 years later. And she said pretty quickly the jealousy between Liam and Noel came along. And the jealousy she attributes to the fact that, you know, Noel had been somebody she really doted on. And she, both Paul and Noel, she really kind of idolized anyway. But when Liam came along, Noel kind of fell out of the limelight. And she figures that some of that was pretty palpable to Noel, and so that resentment seed kind of was planted.
Yeah, and I think what one of the themes through the movie is how people are naturally drawn to Liam. It really comes through. He must have like this really magnetic charisma if you're in his presence, because the way she described even when he was a small kid is that he captivated whatever room he was in. So he had some sort of magic, and it must have been really frustrating to be an older sibling and be, you know, overshadowed just by the sheer personality of a kid. What, 5 years his junior, right?
Yeah.
5 years. That's a huge difference when you're young.
Well, four or 5 years. I mean, there's 3.5, 4 years between us siblings. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a little of that. But his mom also says something really interesting, that she said she would not have wanted Liam in a band without Noel, but that she thought that it happened way too quickly, and that was part of the problem.
Yeah, they talk about it later, but also I think one of the things that really it had to have formed their different personalities is their father was really abused their mother, but she said Noel was the one who got it worst of all.
Yeah.
So he used to really beat on Noel, but never touched Liam. So it's really interesting later on in the movie when they're talking about it, and they have totally different reactions to being in that sort of environment, especially when their dad shows back up. And Noel's very like reserved and philosophical about it, but Liam wanted to kill him.
Yeah, and you would have expected, I would have expected almost the opposite.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that really makes me want to play armchair psychologist, you know, figure out, you know, what the guilt of, you know, having to watch your brother get abused. What that must have done to Liam, and you know how you know shouldering that abuse, you know, must have really affected Noel.
Well, and the resentment of Noel taking that, and then his brother not suffering what he perceives as the consequence of that,
mm-hmm.
And possibly, I mean, again, we're now really delving into some armchair psychology, right? Where, you know, if Noel thinks Liam's not grateful for the fact that he's taking the beating for his little brother.
Yeah, and it seems like maybe Liam was compensating for that by being so angry. But you know, yeah, again, I don't know. It's just it was really fascinating. The dynamic was really surprising and interesting.
But also, if you ask them, they might not themselves know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be the type of thing either one of them really wanted to contemplate and dwell on.
Well, Noel says he doesn't want to talk about it. He never wants to talk about it. When people ask him about it, he's like, "It's somebody's fucking business." Like, it happened, and I have the quote.
Oh, good, because it was a really good one. It was about shouldering the weight.
"I've never been compelled to either talk about it or write about it. It is no one else's business. You can't let that kind of thing affect you in any way, or you are just carrying that through your entire life."
That is unbelievably profound and mature.
It's almost too denialistic, if that's even a word.
I think now.
I just made up a new word. Yep. It's just so much in denial, though. It's one thing to say, okay, it happened, but I'm moving on. But another is like, I'm never talking about this. There's no point to talk about it. Well, there is a little point to talk about it. And to say you never write about it, that's some bullshit.
Yeah.
Because it's evident in his music and some of his lyrics. Maybe not literally, but there is some symbolism. There's some evident pain and catharsis in the music and the melody and the composition. There's more there. Otherwise, I think it wouldn't resonate with people as much as it does, especially considering some of the lyrics are nonsense.
Yeah, especially when you hear the way Noel sings a song versus the way Liam sings a song.
Yes.
Noel's version is invariably
haunting.
Yeah, haunting and sad compared to Liam's, which is much more sort of energetic and poppy.
Which very much fits the whole the whole discussion we just had about the family dynamic. And I think I mentioned maybe in housekeeping last week, after having watched Supersonic, where I said listening to Noel sing like Wonderwall acoustically, it is a different song. It's entirely different. It's a dark, dark, painful song. And Wonderwall, when Liam sings it, is kind of dark, but not doesn't even approach listening to Noel sing it, which is why I delved into some of Noel's solo stuff, and I recommend taking a listen to that if you haven't. There's plenty on Apple Music. Alan wanted the song Bring It On Down as their first single, but Noel felt the drummer wouldn't be able to handle it, so he just decided to write a new song instead, which is where he wrote Supersonic.
That is amazing. Supersonic is an amazing song, but also really simple on the drums.
You're right. And I think Noel said that the band had gone to get, well, he said Chinese food or fish and chips or Chinese fish and chips, whichever. And he wrote the song, quote, "and as long as it took them to eat a Chinese meal." And then this ended up being the 94 debut of Supersonic. I can't fathom that talent. I mean, I'm jealous of it and in awe of it and grateful for it. But just to be able to be like, boom, I need a song. Here's a song. Want to hear about it? Yeah. Here it goes.
Yeah. This first one's not going so well. We need something better.
And then, so Noel says at the debut, and this is another Noel quote. Sorry, I'm going to quote a lot of this movie because I wrote down lots of quotes. Because there's really no, I mean, you got to see the movie, but the quotes are the story. So Noel says, people came along and read about us in the press. Nobody knew any of the songs. But on the day Supersonic came out, I remember people singing the lyrics to Supersonic. They're singing your words back to you. That those nonsensically written words that I wrote down at 3 o'clock in the morning, they were singing back.
Have you listened to much of their later albums after What's the Story of Morning Glory?
A little bit, because I think I mentioned you what Standing on the Shoulder of Giants.
It's really evident how they really were maturing as a band from album to album. Maybe they didn't capture the magic as much from the first two albums, but that third album is really good, and I think underrated. And what you can really see is the evolution of the lyrics. The lyrics get better and better from album to album. Mm-hmm. I mean, and definitely maybe, you know, like he mentioned the lyrics Supersonic or nonsensical. The lyrics are almost just phonetic, you know, to go along with the music. They got a little bit better with What's the Story of Morning Glory, but still, the pretty simple concepts, threw in some heavy-handed metaphors every once in a while. But then you get into the next album, and there's some real substance behind the words. Like, don't go away. That is a brutally, brutally sad song when you listen to the words.
But also, I think as you move forward, you can also tell that it's getting a little more and more produced.
Mm-hmm.
Their production value increased. And so there is a little bit of refinement and maturity, but that also kind of takes away some of their punk that made them popular. So there's this tipping point where they stop to be this punky, plucky British band, and they start to be this more mature. And I hate to make this equation, but I'm going to do it anyway. But not unlike the Beatles.
that's totally fair. I mean, they were so raw, and you can hear it in their first couple albums. They started to get more mature. They started to get more tools in their toolbox that they could use to make music. And it got more sophisticated. And, maybe it didn't work as well after a while. But there's some really good stuff, after What's the Story of Morning Glory that I tend to forget about, because these first two albums are so good.
And also, once you become that successful, you have the freedom to do that, too. You have kind of some more freedom from the record label, maybe, freedom from being poor and failing. You have a lot of artistic freedom, but you have a lot of physical, tangible freedom because you have tools at your disposal and money, which, money is power. But Noel says very openly that trouble seemed to find them. They ended up being banned from hotels because the guys would all throw all the shit out the window, the hotel window. And Noel was really offended by that. He was really kind of the proper, almost the parent figure. He said, I realized what it took to make that hotel room. And I was kind of upset at all of this behavior. But at this point...
Well, he also had the sort of the stoner mentality of like, do you know how much work it takes to destroy a hotel room? Like, you're working up a sweat. So he was also a little baffled that they would want to spend that energy.
And at this point, they are now dubbed the Sex Beatles. Kind of a takeoff from the Sex Pistols, because at this point, they're kind of sex symbol-esque, I guess. And the British teen girls were all agog. And then Noel was quoted as saying, when it's all said and done, our music will stand the test of time. We won't be here. We won't mean anything, but the music will stand. And this is where they end up on the Amsterdam ferry.
Which sounds like a fun trip.
It does sound like a fun trip. And it sounds like Liam, again, is the ringmaster troublemaker, starting all kinds of ruckus, which Noel says it's like a Benny Hill skit. And they end up in the brig. Liam said, that's how I want my rock stars to act.
Yep. Good job.
And Noel says, if that's how you're going to act, get the fuck out of my band.
Yeah, that didn't take long.
And then Noel felt very early that, people were only showing up at their gigs to cause trouble.
Yeah, I mean, once they got the reputation of being a bad boy band, it seemed like people just wanted to fuck with them.
But I think Alan McGee, was it Alan McGee, said when Noel told him what happened on the ship, he was worried, and Alan was like, "That's brilliant. You guys got kicked." Yeah. Brilliant. That's the best. That's the best publicity for a band. That's rock star behavior.
Yeah. And as punk as Noel was, and he was, he didn't give a fuck about what you thought about him. He was still like the consummate professional when it came to the actual music and the actual gigs. He was so offended if they did anything that would jeopardize the gig. Which is funny because he didn't care about anything else.
And this is when Noel says, "I know my brother better than anybody else." And that's how he says that Liam is a dog and he's a cat. Noel's a cat.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, he admits, he's like, "I'm an asshole, man." And then he follows it up with, when they're talking about, is there anybody expendable in the band? Everybody's expendable. Except for you two? No, even Liam's expendable.
Even Liam, yeah. He couldn't even help himself.
Nope. He says, "I've accepted it. I'm a bastard."
Yeah, and this is around the time that their manager, I guess it was after they recorded the album, but their manager seems like disappeared into a world of drugs.
Yeah, and they have some handlers around, and one of the handlers very, very clear-headed says, you know, "Noel has a lot of buttons and Liam has a lot of fingers."
Again, that's such like a little brother talent.
And they talk about, you know, democracy never works in a band. And you had the two people that were both vying for control. And that's what became the struggle / strength / creative force of the band.
Yeah, and you can see in the clips they have, you know, in retrospect, it's actually kind of sad, the dynamic that, you know, Liam is the one that everybody really likes to hang out with and everybody thinks is fun and, you know, and always the center of attention. And you could tell Noel resents this on some level. And Noel is certainly the smarter of the two, even though they're both pretty smart. And Noel really like cuts him down a lot. And you can tell it gets to Liam, like it hurts his feelings. And that just makes him act out even more.
He just wants his older brother's approval and his older brother wants him to chill the fuck out.
And neither one of them are ever going to get what they want, which is so sad.
Well, except for the fact that Noel puts Liam in front to act up. If Liam weren't acting up to a certain point, then they wouldn't have achieved success. Yeah. If Liam hadn't been as outgoing and as emotive and obnoxious, he might not have caught the eye as he did. And this is where they end up going into the recording studio. And it didn't sound right. This is where their sound didn't sound right. And Noel just wanted to be done with it. He said, "Just put it out. We'll just, you know, we'll fix it in the second album, but just get, I want to be done with this." And they were like, "There will not be a second album if we don't get this right." And so, you know, they got Owen Morris to come in and mix it. And then that's when everything caught fire.
Well, before that, that's when they brought in Mark Coyle to actually do the mixing, because he was the one that made them sound so awesome live. But even he couldn't quite get it right.
That didn't translate to studio recording.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great in a live venue, but not great in a studio. Different engineering, different editing, Brother E. And then they end up being the fastest selling debut album in England, which is impressive. And then, this is 94 still, they roll into their Japan. And Noel was amazed by this, that the people were waiting for them and screaming their names. Is that how the people even know our names? Why are all these people that don't even speak English going crazy?
And this is really where the band seemed happiest, because they were reaping all the accolades and really enjoying success for the first time. And none of the other bullshit had started to creep in yet.
Well,
it wouldn't really start going downhill for a long time after that, but that was like the last time there was such unbridled joy in being the rock stars that they became so quickly.
Well, and also
in this movie, anyway,
their behavior hadn't quite escalated into full thermonuclear warfare at that point.
Right. This was before any self-sabotage.
Yeah, they hadn't quite amassed their mad levels of strategic stockpile. So, and then they have the Null talks about the abuse a little bit, where he says, "I don't talk about it," except he just talked about it. And then Peggy admits, mom says that, when she left with the boys, when she left their father, that it made the boys bitter. And she wonders what kind of lingering effect that has on them.
I know. I'm so interested. I want to like send Dr. Drew over there just to dig around in Noel's brain.
Well, and Noel says that he feels in a small way that his father may have beat some of the talent into him, which is, I think, why A, he doesn't talk about it, and B, he's not as resentful, because I think he's justified some of the abuse by saying, I may not have been this creative without the abuse. I may not have been this person without the abuse. I may not have been able to write like this without the abuse. So he's turned that negative into, I will say in a small way, a positive, because I don't want to put abuse in a positive light, but in his mind, from his words, I interpret that he is making it out to be a positive event. He's turning what happened to him, and he's choosing to view it in a positive only light, which, you know, you can argue.
Yeah. I mean, for the context of this movie, he's exhibiting very little resentment about the circumstances of his upbringing. It's an amazing perspective to hear.
And now they move to America, where they're virtually unknown.
Oh, that was such an awful interview to listen to, where that woman, that radio interviewer was. Well, she was full on condescending.
Oh yeah, where she was trying to interpret.
And we've got the two Gallagher brothers from the band Oasis. You're playing at the Whiskey tonight. Is it sold out?
Of course.
Do you know?
It's sold out.
Okay. And what have you been doing?
I've just been doing all those interviews and gigs. Working, and Melissa's been making us work that hard. She's on top.
I think what they said was there were some interviews and hanging out and doing work and stuff.
You're right.
I'll be the translator here.
Stoodle, roodle, poodle, doodle. Take the roodie, the boo.
Anything else?
Yeah. No, it was pretty typically stupid American.
Yeah, and they were having none of it.
Yeah, well, and she was too stupid to get it.
Yeah.
Because they were making fun of her and she didn't get it. And Mark Coyle says, you know, breaking America oftentimes breaks the band. Because when bands come back from America, the carpet doesn't look the same. And this is where the Whiskey a Go-Go happens.
Yeah, somebody introduced them to... They're already unabashed drug users, but this is where somebody introduced them to crystal meth, which they treated like cocaine.
And one of the band members said that they didn't care what, that they would have a go at anything as long as they could sleep, have a cup of tea and sleep after. And right. That was why they were not a fan of what they called... Ninja Coke.
Liam seemed like a fan of it.
This crystal meth is Ninja Coke. This is no good stuff. It caused everyone to perform poorly, and I guess they gave Liam a different set list than the rest of the band when they tried to perform. So as he was going through his songs, he was singing different songs and everybody was playing different parts of different songs, and it was just a disaster. Which is kind of a metaphor for why you don't do meth.
Yeah, and Liam was ducking behind the stage during the performance to snort more lines of crystal meth.
Which pissed Noel off to no end.
Yeah, so much so that he quit the band and left.
And Noel says that this is the time where everything changed for him. This is where now everything was me and them in the band. That's how it was. And that's when Noel splits to San Francisco.
And there's a B-side that he wrote called Talk Tonight, right?
Talk Tonight.
Which is, that is a beautiful song.
Sitting on my own, chewing on a bone, 1,000 million miles from home, something is between the eyes, sleeping on a plane, you know you can't complain. You took your last chance once again. I landed stranded, hardly even knew your name, but I wanna talk tonight until the morning light about how you saved my life. You and me see how we are. You and me see how we are.
It's painful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a painful song. And hearing him sing it is just knowing now what I do, having seen the movie, listening to the song, I can feel the same emotion that he is portraying, which is frightening.
Yeah. And again, hearing him sing it is totally different.
Yeah.
Than the band singing it.
Absolutely.
Also, the one of the sad parts is, he left the band to go hang out with a girl he met and had a fling with in San Francisco. But now he can't even remember her name or face.
Yeah.
So
wrote a song about her figuratively and doesn't remember anything about her. But, you know, remembers it as a fond time, but that it wasn't going to last. Just a thing in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a little Noel running around San Francisco. And then the new era started, and Noel was different.
Yeah, what he wanted to start performing his own songs.
And I think Mark says at this point that Noel can only let his emotions out when he's in the recording booth, that he claims to have no emotions, but once he's behind the glass of the booth and there's a microphone in front of him, that emotion pours out of him whether he realizes it or not.
Yeah, it was around this time, too, when he realized that he couldn't take their drummer anymore.
That's right. Tony.
He decided there's no way Tony was going to be able to actually play the new songs he was writing.
Yeah. He specifically said there's no way Tony could do Wonderwall or Champagne. This wasn't going to happen.
Which reminded me of a quote I think Noel had earlier about one of the fights he and Liam had on stage. And this really cracked me up. But both times I watched the movies, he said, Liam ended up throwing a tambourine at him during the set. He's like, and that wasn't even in time either.
Yeah, when it landed, because that wasn't in time either. It was hilarious. It's those kind of digs, those kind of brother digs
mm-hmm.
that probably only mean probably only really mean something to each other. It also makes you wonder, and this is just an independent pondering, wonder if either of them have watched this.
They have.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the director screened it for both of them.
Wow.
And they were both happy with how it turned out. What Noel was mostly concerned about is he didn't want it to be a movie where a bunch of, how did he put it? It was something, I'm going to butcher what he actually said, but it was something like he didn't want a bunch of 40-year-old wankers sitting around talking about how great things used to be. He didn't want that kind of movie. So
except that's the movie that they got.
not really. I mean, they talk about, you know, they talk about the good times and the bad.
And then they flow into now they're recording Morning Glory. And they were basically working on a song a day, which was amazing. The production staff was amazed. They couldn't believe that they could accomplish a song a day. It was unheard of. But they were pushing the equipment so hard that the equipment was quite literally catching on fire.
And they were having epic fights.
Yeah.
Which was really unnerving to the drummer, who has been a drummer for like 2 weeks in the band. I think that was the cricket bat fight where Liam also threw a trash can at a car as it was driving away. And the drummer was like, what the hell is going on? And was even more disturbed when the rest of the band was like, oh, this happens all the time.
Yeah. So this is where they talk about where Noel would play a tune for Liam. Liam would listen to it once. He would go in the booth and he would sing it after having heard it once. Sing it, land it flawlessly. Noel would come in and listen to it playback and be like, nope, you got it. And then they'd be done. And then they'd go out. And then what would happen, and this is what happened, is Liam would go out and Noel would go back into creating a new song or a new track. But he'd be in the booth with his guitar and they would all have nothing to do. And so they would go out to the pub and drink and get drugs. And he brought a bunch of people from the pub back one night. And that's what escalated, is because somehow something happened.
One of Noel's guitars got damaged and he lost his shit.
And that's when it all started. And that was the cricket bat. But you're right. The band said after all the strife and the fights, they'd all get back together like nothing happened. But Griggs couldn't handle it. And it was being pushed basically to a breakdown. And Noel says, he didn't know if it was exhaustion that was making him nervous or the nerves that were making him exhausted.
It's a great line. But yeah, so Griggs was really like the most laid back, like the quintessential stoner of the band. So yeah, I'm sure after a while, he just couldn't take the chaos anymore.
Well, it's got to be, you got to be adrenalized all the time if you're worried about there's going to be a cricket bat to the head and you're going to be around that. I can only imagine. I only had an experience fleeing from a fireplace poker, so, you know, I can't imagine. But no. But
that wasn't me, right?
Oh, no. That was like my senior prom, my mom.
No. Okay.
His mom went after her sister with a fireplace poker.
Mm.
But at any rate, and Noel, who says, when Griggs is like, I'm out. And Noel says, well, we're going to find somebody. And even if my mom has to play the bass, the gig goes on.
Yeah, this is when they were going to go over and play David Letterman, right? So they got a replacement bassist who backed out.
And so they just decided to do it as a four set, right?
Yeah, and Noel was so offended. He's like, this is the chance of a lifetime. And he had an amazing quote, because the new bass player was like, I can't take it. I want to be here and spend some time with my bird.
Yes.
Which turns out is British slang for a lady friend. And Noel said to me like, that better be one fucking fit bird.
Yes. And now they roll into Earl's Court in 1995. And they get Griggs to come back after the replacement bass player backs out. And they're all there. And Noel's quote is, "There, we're there because we need each other."
And this is when they are blowing up.
And this is when at the barrel ends, Liam walks off. And really, this is where Noel, his level of offense is stepped up to a degree where he just decides, fine, Noel is going to start singing now. If Liam's going to jump off the stage and be a little pill, Noel's just going to take care of business. But the problem is, this became self-perpetuating because the more Noel would do it, the more it would piss off Liam. And so the more Liam would do it because Noel would enable him to do it. So it just became this escalating cycle of where Liam could see where he could push Noel's buttons.
And again, this is one of the parts that I found really illuminating about the movie is, you know, on the surface, it seems like Liam's just being a dick, but it's actually much sadder than that. It's Liam is worried about his role in the band because Noel is starting to sing more songs. You know, he actually recorded the lead vocals for Don't Look Back in Anger on the album and had already been playing like Wonderwall and I think a couple other acoustic songs live by himself. You know, and Liam recognized that he doesn't write music. He doesn't play an instrument, although he's credited with the tambourine, which I always think is funny. So he's just there to sing and be the front man. And so when Noel wants to sing a couple songs, he either has to, you know, go off stage or come back or just sit in the back and shake the tambourine. And, you know, it's really sad. He was feeling like he didn't have a place at that point. And that's what just exacerbated him walking off because he didn't really know what he was doing anymore.
He said he felt like a yo-yo.
Yeah.
And he didn't, you know, and so you very clearly feel like he feels he's being made obsolete, even though I don't think that was Noel's intent. I think Noel just wanted to get that out of him to kind of exercise mm-hmm. those demons. But it was a threat to Liam because you're right, Liam, his only role was to be the front man. And if he didn't have that as the role, then you're right. What was he there for?
Yeah, and that's a much sadder statement than, you know, Liam was just being a dick and walking out during the middle of a set, which is still partly true.
Yeah, and again, the more that happened, Noel just couldn't, he just did not abide that. It just offended his sense of showmanship. He just wouldn't mm-hmm. have it. So the tension grew. But Noel says that there's nothing extraordinary about any of his songs. Instead, it's the millions of people singing them back to him that makes the songs extraordinary. Which I think is a pretty poetic bit of humility.
Yeah, he says a statement like that a couple different times throughout the movie. So he certainly really, really believes it. I think later towards the end when he's talking about Nebworth, you know, he says something like, you know, it's not the fact that they're doing something great is what makes the 250,000 people there. It's the fact that 250,000 people show up to hear them is the great part.
And this is a point where the band now starts to change. There is a metamorphosis, not of their doing as much as it is from the environment. And the band has now started to become a brand and an industry. And they're being pushed now to make money. And it starts to take its toll on the spirit of the band because no longer are they this little punk band that's doing gigs. They're now supporting crew and cast and people and industry and tours and demands. And so now they've become business people.
They have become the establishment.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting sued by former drummers who they fired.
And they said it made it real. It made them in the present when they didn't want to be. They wanted to be a band. They didn't want to be dragged into court or having to deal with reality. That was stuff for other people.
They just wanted to be fucking rock stars.
And at this point, Mark couldn't handle the noise anymore. He was starting to lose his hearing. And he said, you know, my biggest regret is that I had to quit the band, but I had to do it. And even though I regretted it, it was still the right thing to do. Which is an interesting point of view.
And that other guy. I don't know if you caught that, but Noel made a big deal about the other roadie like quitting around the same time. Yeah. I think that was the first time he'd ever been mentioned in the movie.
Even though he was there for like a blink and a half.
Well, he may have been there for a really long time. They just never talked about him before. That's what it seemed like.
They said Mark was also basically the honorary fifth member of the band.
Yeah.
You know, he was a fixture and that they were sad to see him go, but then they moved on to Ireland, and this is where Ireland claimed them, and Ireland claimed them as if they were their own. And this was the point where it became clear that at that time bands didn't really have security, and then they ended up at the after party in the bar where good old dad shows up at the behest of the tabloids. And it's interesting that the tabloids, I mean, we grew up with the tabloids around, I guess, a little bit, but I never really had much exposure to them. I guess the tabloids in England are much, much different, much more prevalent, much more popular, perhaps, because I can't imagine some of the behaviors. But again, our press here is goofy anyway, so maybe it happened, but the tabloids basically propped up their dad to go see them. And this is where Noel sees it happening and wants to put a stop to it. And he knows that Liam's going to just attack. So he very clearly tries to back Liam off the ledge and get him away and protect him. And he does, because he knows that Liam's just going to kill him. And so Noel steps up his big brother and says, no, we're not doing this.
Yeah. He's not worth it.
Right. There's no point. And mm-hmm. So Noel just says, we're out of here. And then they have that brief telephone encounter where their dad is calling and trying to get details. And I can't get really tickets. And he says, and you're not gonna. And then they end up hanging up on him.
You're not gonna. And if you show up, I'm gonna murder you.
I'm gonna break your legs, I think he says.
And again, it's, this is a phone call that the tabloids put the father up to make, because they were recording it.
And charging people to listen to it. You could call.
Yes.
You could call the line, the telephone line.
So, so shady.
That's what I was saying. I mean, the British tabloids are so different. Here, if you've 39p, 39p for a phone call to hear this minute, less than a minute.
That's how big they were at this point, though. I mean, that is a legitimate money-making enterprise, just to have a phone line where you can hear Liam yelling at his dad.
And at this point of the movie now, they have returned to the imagery of Nebworth, where Noel says, this is where the quote that you quoted, where he says, it did feel like the end of something more than it felt like the beginning of something.
Oh, no, that's just devastating.
But also amazing that they were that aware, or he was that aware, to be that in the moment, to realize at the peak of your greatness that was the peak. And you knew it was the peak, and you knew that everything was downhill. Although you could debate whether it was downhill or if it was just going to a different peak.
Yeah, but the Nebworth concerts were amazing. I think they said in the movie, 4% of the population put in for a lottery to get tickets.
Yeah, which is amazing. And that they sold out the first show in just a matter of minutes.
Yeah, I mean, the band were concerned that they wouldn't even be able to sell out such a big venue.
And then they did it for two nights.
Yeah, and someone was telling them, let's do four nights. And they're like, no. Because they didn't want to, be embarrassed by not selling out. So right. They're like, let's just do two. Turns out they could have done seven.
Yeah, easily. And then Liam was like, let's do it forever.
Oh, that's so Liam.
Yeah. And Noel says that Nebworth, this was Noel's quote, which I think was, again, very cogent on his part, that Nebworth was the last great gathering of people before the birth of the internet, to the degree that it is, and that gatherings of that magnitude just don't happen anymore because the industry around it doesn't really foster it happening anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting take on how the culture has changed and the music industry has changed, and a big part of that is the prevalence of music on the internet. People don't have to work so hard to seek it out. They don't have to go to a big concert to get the experience.
Well, and most people's attention span nowadays is not going to sustain long enough to get a plane ticket, fly over to England, get tickets, having got tickets to a concert to go stand in line in a field and wait for them to perform. If I can't get it on Twitter, or I can't get it on YouTube, I can't get it on Amazon, I can't get it on demand, I can't watch it on my iPhone, I can't right now, I'm going to go into the next big thing because I just don't have time. Which, again, then you start sounding like, I start sounding like I'm the old man. I'm like, that's just not the way it was. But progress, right?
Yeah, well, and part of it is, like movies, you can get such a good experience now at home with, availability of content and technology. You don't have to go to a movie theater to get a really good experience. You can have the surround sound. For music, you can have the high quality audio files. You can get amazing speakers for your home. So you don't have to, go to a big venue to have a transcendent musical experience anymore.
But there's something in that collective audience. There's something being in it. And again, I don't disagree with you. I have a 7.2 surround sound in my living room and I have a giant TV, and I hate going to the movies because I hate people.
Yeah.
But there is something sometimes about going to a theater with people in it, and you get a different experience in watching the movie.
Absolutely.
This summer, I saw the original Dune on an IMAX screen at the local, it's OMSI here, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. They have a science fiction exhibit, is the wrong word, but they had a science fiction deal this summer where they were playing different science fiction movies every night of the week for a couple weeks. So Dune was one of them. I want to say 2001 was one of them. There was a whole Aliens was one of them. And so there's this whole bunch of movies, but going and watching them, and I took boyfriend Jesse and one of my other friends went with us, and it was amazing. And it's a terrible movie. It's a terrible movie. I own it. I love it, but it's a terrible movie. But watching it on a giant screen in a theater full of other people that want to watch it is a different experience than if I had made him watch it on the couch at home with me.
Sure.
Now, you could argue one's better, one's not. Meh. It's the same movie, right? But sometimes it's the experience that makes it. So, context in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the thing nowadays is you don't have to. You have options.
Sure. You're right. Yeah. Lots of options. Lots of options. So that is the end of my notes for Supersonic. Again, I think that it's worth seeing. Even if you're not an Oasis fan, it's a fascinating story about a band. So even if you don't like Oasis, I think it's worth a watch. If you like Oasis, you're going to like the movie. If you love Oasis, you're going to watch it as many times as I do. So buy it. So I enjoyed it very much. I've seen it now. Like I said, I think I've seen it 4 times. So and it doesn't, the amazing thing, and I don't know if you'll have this experience, but you can tell me, I watch it. And I want to stop it halfway through and go back to the beginning, cause I don't want to go to the end, but I feel so sad. It makes me feel so sad. But it doesn't seem like I'm watching it over a period of 2 hours. It just takes away the time.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that because we sort of decided we were going to do this at the last minute. So I was prepared for another movie, but it had been a couple weeks since I'd seen it. So I wanted to refresh myself. So I bought it and I thought, there are a couple points where I don't remember as well as I want to. So I thought I would just, watch a little bit of it because it was late and I had to work in the morning. Turns out I ended up watching the whole thing because it is that engrossing. Yeah, it's almost 2 hours. It doesn't feel like it.
I think the trap of it is because, and it's a good thing. It's a good trap to fall into, but I think the trap of it is because you get enough interview and then they throw the music at you and that hooks you. And so it's that little bit of heroin that just kind of strings you along.
Yeah. I mean, it, like you said, if you like Oasis, you're going to love this movie. But I think if you're just interested in generally the creative process and especially music, how bands are formed and, an example of, how a band makes it big. This is a really compelling story. I mean, if you wrote this as fiction, you wouldn't really believe it. It doesn't ring true because it's so out there because these kids, I mean, they were just kids. They didn't know what the fuck they were doing. And it was just magic. Collectively, they were so talented and it was just the perfect time that they blew up before they even knew what was going on. We talked about it as far as the lyrics go. I mean, their lyrics were really pretty lame early on.
But they just weren't.
Oh yeah. But they hadn't even reached their full maturity as artists and they were people. So huge. Yeah. Absolutely.
They weren't even adults.
Yeah, so it's fascinating to be able to watch that and experience it along with them. And really, really tremendously heartbreaking knowing how it ends and knowing that the brothers don't speak to each other right now. You know, they couldn't even get together for a 20th anniversary of their first two big albums. So maybe for the 25th anniversary, they'll do something. That'd be fun to look forward to. But yeah, Oasis, it's still worming its way in my brain. I can't get them out.
No, that's okay. I think you just need a phaser like in Star Trek 2 to be able to get that thing out of your ear. So
yeah.
But no, and the point that I will make too is that it's unfortunate that Brother E is not with us, even though he hasn't seen it yet. But by this point, he better have watched it. I should just buy him a copy and send him. In fact, I think I will just buy and send him the copy electronically.
That'll be good, so he can edit some clips in.
But I'm grateful that the three of us brothers have been able to do this as a project and maintain. And because of that, I feel we have a bond between us through this project that is great. And so I'm grateful for that in a way that this movie kind of makes me realize that I'm grateful and I think I'm becoming better for the experience because I'm getting to learn about my brothers in a way that I wouldn't have normally. And I would only hope that for the Gallagher brothers. So
that would make that would make Eric the Noel of the group and you the Liam. Wow. And I guess me the other brother.
How do you figure that?
Well, Eric is sort of the creative force behind this project. You are definitely more of the front man.
So that makes you Paul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to be Paul.
I don't know how happy I'm being Liam, but well, we'll go with it. Maybe we should just get shirts made.
I'm a Liam.
Yeah, Liam, Paul, Noel. Nobody will get it, but the three of us will laugh.
Yeah, that's fine.
Or we can make a new emoji logo for the podcast. Confuse the hell out of everybody. So, any other final thoughts on Oasis Supersonic?
No, it was quite enjoyable. Watching it again for the second time in 3 weeks. I discovered a live album that Noel did. I sent you a screenshot of it. But he did like a live benefit concert at the Royal Albert Hall, and it's great. It's still when he was in Oasis. It's before they broke up. So it's got, he did a lot of B-sides, but he did like Wonderwall and Don't Look Back in Anger. He did Cast No Shadow, which, unfortunately for you, since it's your favorite song, that's probably the weirdest arrangement on that album.
I look forward to it. Nah, I like alternate interpretations. I love that kind of stuff.
I don't know that it's great, but it is very different.
Great's relative.
But no, that's a really good album. That was really fun to listen to.
Apple Music.
That's where I got it. It's called, I think, the Dreams Children Make.
Yeah, you've texted it to me. I have it. I just haven't looked at it yet. So,
yeah, I'm looking it up just so we can have it on the podcast. It's The Dreams We Have as Children.
It just before I started finishing that, it was terrible English. I was almost halfway through the rewatch today. I had to stop. My lunch hour was over. So I came home and we had dinner and we were watching the Colbert Late Night with Stephen Colbert, because it's kind of my ritual. My ritual is that I watch Rachel Maddow and then I watch Stephen Colbert, but lately I can't watch Rachel Maddow because I can't watch politics right now because I will just slip my wrist. So I watched Stephen Colbert and The Pretenders were on.
Oh, wow.
And I was amazed at how good Chrissy Hynde looks. And I thought, how old is she? And she's 65 years old. She's doing good. She's doing amazing. But playing with her on stage, I told Jesse, I said, that is the guy. That's the guitarist from the Black Keys. He's like, what? And sure enough, so for some reason, the guitarist of the Black Keys is playing with the Pretenders.
Was it Dan Auerbach?
Yes. Because he's got a very distinctive face.
Mm-hmm.
He's unmistakable.
He has a good solo album, by the way.
Oh, all right. I'll have to check it out. I like the Black Keys, so I imagine he does quite well. So I just thought that was interesting to throw in a little bit of music. Because I've always been a Pretenders fan from when I was even a wee tot, so. Although I'm hoping my introduction to the Pretenders wasn't Gung Ho the movie, but it might have been.
I don't remember a Pretenders song in Gung Ho.
I think Don't Get Me Wrong was one of the songs used in Gung Ho.
Who knew at the time that Michael Keaton would become such a tremendous actor?
There may be Back in the Chain Gang again. That may be also used in Gung Ho, but I might be confused because I kept thinking when I was watching The Man from One Red Shoe that the quote, "a very hairy, scary Larry," was from that movie, but turns out it wasn't.
Okay. What movie was it from?
A Threesome. Which is a movie I think I am the only one of the three brothers Anderson that have seen, but maybe not.
I have not seen it.
I think it's a Baldwin flick.
Stephen Baldwin.
I think so.
Yeah. I remember when it came out. It was a big deal. Also like the actress from The Practice who got really freaky skinny.
I don't
know. Laura Flynn Boyle.
From Twin Peaks.
Oh, okay.
That's where I know her from.
Okay.
Yes, Laura Flynn Boyle, I'm positive. But now I'm going to look it up because, yes, Laura Flynn Boyle, Josh Charles, and Stephen Baldwin.
Oh, Josh Charles. Nice.
Yeah. What's a different movie? Oh, Alexis Arquette is in that movie.
Of course.
Yeah, it was a terrible movie. Of course, I haven't seen it in a million years, so maybe it's better than I remember, but I doubt it. So,
well, you remembered that very specific quote from it.
A very scary Hairy Larry. I don't know why. I don't know why I remember that. So clearly there's something wrong with my head.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about
The Man with One Red Shoe.
That was an interesting movie.
I got notes for that.
It was a different time.
It definitely was a different time. That is for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Misogyny alert. So hope maybe that will be next week. Hopefully by this time next week, there is a working expedition. So.
Yes, and I know that this will be too late, but happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving. Almost Christmas. And I will, I'll put the file up for Mr. Brother E, and then I will go buy him that copy right now. He better watch. You better have watched it by now, Eric. Mm-hmm. All right.
Thank you for the movie, Brother J. Well, hello, sock puppet, Eric.
Oh, Heidi, you got a great sock puppet.
All right. Better go.
All right. Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.